From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Due in no small part to the two-week break between the NFL's conference championship games and tomorrow's Super Bowl, there is no shortage of super stuff and surpassing weirdness emanating from Houston. Ahead, marketing expert Bernice Kanner's history of Super Bowl advertising, and, of course, Paul Attner's take on the hoedown in the Bayou City. Also ahead, the 10th edition of Super Bowl Haiku Poetry, in which we retire an old favorite. And, believe it or not, some non-Super Bowl-related sports stories.
Two of the words I would use to describe the Panthers are very tough and physical, and I think they're well-coached.
Heck, let that get in there. Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The U.S. military says three American soldiers were killed in Iraq today when a homemade bomb exploded on a road between Kirkuk and Tikrit. The military says the bomb blew up about 25 miles southwest of Kirkuk as a U.S. convoy from the 4th Infantry Division passed by. Kirkuk is a major oil-producing area in Iraq. In the northern Iraqi city of Mosul, a car bomb exploded today in front of an Iraqi police station, killing at least nine Iraqis. A military spokesperson says no Americans were killed in that attack. Witnesses and hospital officials say they saw severed limbs in the street. The Mars rover known as Opportunity has rolled off its lander. It's the second rover to move onto the Martian surface, joining the rover Spirit, which landed 3 weeks ago on the other side of the red planet. NPR's Joel Pelka has more.
The six-wheeled rovers are essentially field geologists. They each have an arm that can place instruments on rocks and into soil. One of the instruments is a camera that can take microscopic images. Two others are designed to measure the chemical and mineral structure of the rocks. And then there's the RAT, or rock abrasion tool, for scraping the grunge off rocks for a better look at what's underneath. Opportunity landed in a small crater about 65 feet across and 9 feet deep. Ultimately, scientists expect the rover to drive out of the crater and explore the surrounding plains. On the other side of Mars, the Spirit rover has begun exploring its surroundings, although computer problems have hampered operations. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
In the run-up to Tuesday's primaries and caucuses, John Kerry campaigned last night in Delaware. The Massachusetts senator plans to visit each of the seven states holding a caucus or primary next week between now and Tuesday. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
On a frigid night in Delaware, Kerry spoke inside a crowded and hot union hall. Pledging his support to organized labor, Kerry invoked the memory of September 11th.
Every single one of those firefighters and police officers who climbed those stairs and gave their lives so that others might live was a member of organized labor, and they believed in the right to organize, the right to do better, the right to be able to have a living wage.
Hours before this appearance at an electrical workers' union hall, Kerry received the endorsement of another labor group, the Communication Workers of America. Kerry scheduled to spend Saturday in Missouri and Oklahoma. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Newcastle, Delaware.
China's health ministry has confirmed a new case of SARS, but says the patient has already gone home from the hospital. The case was reported in China's southern Guangzhou province, the same region where SARS first appeared in November of 2002. There have been three other confirmed SARS cases in China. The official Chinese news agency says all three were pronounced recovered and discharged from a hospital in Guangzhou province. Last year, more than 770 people died from the disease. 349 of them were in China. This is NPR. The World Health Organization is calling for immediate action by Chinese officials to stop the spread of the bird flu, one day after tests showed the virus has been in chickens since at least April. The report calmed fears of the disease leading to a human pandemic. Meanwhile, Asian officials have been telling the public the virus is under control and that poultry is safe to eat if properly cooked. The WHO wants China to increase its monitoring for more possible cases of the flu jumping to humans. A settlement has been reached in a federal desegregation lawsuit over public housing in East Texas. The case has lasted more than 20 years. Bill Zeeble with member station KERA in Dallas has more on the story.
The 1980 lawsuit alleged public housing discrimination in 36 counties, from Texarkana down to Vidor and other cities. A judge found whites were intentionally housed in white parts of towns, African Americans in black sections, and so he ordered an end to discrimination. But one of the lead attorneys, Laura Becerra, says by 1995, HUD still had not met the judge's order for enough desegregated housing units.
HUD was in contempt of court. I think that was a huge part of the impetus.
Becerra says HUD finally spent nearly $100 million to right the discrimination wrongs. It has two more years to create 1,500 more desegregated housing opportunities for minorities. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
San Mateo County, California officials have found an easy way to raise revenue. They're charging television stations $51,000 to reserve a spot next to the courthouse for the Scott Peterson murder trial. Yesterday's announcement was greeted with stunned silence, then laughter by reporters and photographers covering the trial. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ready the chips, prepare the dip. At 6:25 tomorrow evening, the Carolina Panthers and the New England Patriots will meet in Super Bowl 38, the event to be held in Houston, Texas. Folks who, even at this late date, need a primer for the big game could choose no better mentor than New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick. The normally stone-faced Belichick made headlines last week when he cracked wise for a weird moment during a press conference and advised his players not to get arrested during the festivities leading up to the game. More representative of Coach Belichick's style was his response to a question about whether the Pats or the Panthers had the edge as far as receivers are concerned.
There's only two things that matter for a receiver. You know, every receiver has to be able to do them one or the other, one way or the other, and that's get open and catch the ball. If you can't do those two things, I don't know how you can play receiver.
On one level, it's as simple as that. Actually, on several levels, it's as simple as that. At another point in the same press conference, Coach Belichick said, quote, "The closer you get to the goal line, the more important the plays are, because the higher the likelihood that points will be involved." Wise heads nodded at that one, too. Without question, Bill Belichick's approach has worked. His Patriots are riding a 14-game winning streak, an exceptional achievement in any football season. But at a press conference in Houston this week, Pats linebacker Willie McGinest put that accomplishment in precisely the context that Coach Belichick would have suggested.
I mean, what does a streak mean if you lose the big game? Who cares about a streak if you come out here and lose? That's fine. I know we're not downplaying our accomplishments, but, you know, our goal is bigger than just the streak.
On three, go Panthers. One, two!
Of course, the other side is pursuing the same goal, that the Carolina Panthers, quite recently losers of 15 games in a single season, are appearing in the Super Bowl may qualify as a genuine surprise, but nobody associated with Carolina is saying that the Panthers are just happy to be there. At a raucous rally this week in Charlotte, pro wrestler Ric Flair took a turn at motivating the mob WWE style, by predicting the mayhem the Patriots quarterback would suffer at the hands of one of the Panthers' linemen.
Tom Brady, you told the world you were slow with a weak arm. We already know that. This is Charlotte. And what are you going to do when Mike Riker drops the bomb on you?
Charlotte is in the heart of college basketball country. The Panthers are a relatively new arrival, but nothing builds a fan base like success. And in pro football, only winning the Super Bowl shouts success more loudly than earning the right to show up. Still, at least one transplanted football fan argued at the Panthers rally that the case for Charlotte as a pro football town hadn't yet entirely been made.
I think it'll take a few things. I'm originally from Denver, and whenever there's Monday Night Football or whenever they're in the playoffs, crime goes to zero. So if crime goes to zero around here during the game, hey, they've arrived.
The setting of this year's football extravaganza could be said to have re-arrived. The Super Bowl was last held in Houston 30 years ago, when Miami beat Minnesota 24-7 at Rice Stadium. Regarding various players and members of the media who'd rather have been in New Orleans for the past week or so, Mickey Herskowitz, a columnist with the Houston Chronicle, acknowledges that they have a point.
You know, Houston has never really been a destination city. We're not famed for our beauty. But there's a tremendous energy and a dynamic here that makes this city interesting. I don't know if this is worth bragging about or not, but we're probably the stadium capital of the world. We've got $1 billion worth of stadiums now with Reliance Stadium and for football and Minute Maid Park for baseball and the Toyota Center for basketball.
I hope Mr. Herskowitz didn't leave any corporations out. But the designation Stadium Capital of the World notwithstanding, it's fair to say that football, from the high school level on up, or down if you're a Texan, is part of Houston's life force, at least as Mickey Herskowitz sees it.
This may be the football capital of the universe. I always have said we didn't know how important religion was in this state and this city until people started comparing it to football.
That comparison is especially apropos on Super Bowl Sunday, when football, God, and country become hopelessly, perhaps gloriously, tossed into the same black and blue and red, white, and blue recipe for excess. We've been hearing about this monstrous event for almost 2 weeks, and not only from sports reporters, but from drama critics, food columnists, astrologers, and everybody else the nation's newspapers and radio and TV stations could dragoon into Super Bowl service. So in the interests of perspective, we'll return to the point of view of a fellow who's never lost sight of the fact that the centerpiece of tomorrow's shenanigans is a football game where certain constants apply.
Look, the name of the game's points. If you don't score points, you're not going to win. And if you give them up, you're going to lose.
Thank you, Coach Belichick. May the best team win, and when the game's over, may everybody involved, fans included, walk away under their own power. Joining me now on the line is Paul Attner, who is currently in Houston to cover the Super Bowl for the Sporting News and, of course, for Only a Game. Hello, Paul.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be back with you.
Let us waste no time in getting to your pick. One of Houston's many nicknames is the Clutch City. So, which team playing tomorrow comes through in the clutch?
I know you won't believe this, but I'm picking the Patriots. After all these years of holding out, I've become a Patriot believer, and which automatically probably means they're in trouble.
Anyway, I was going to say, can they bear this?
Probably Patriot fans out there don't want me to come anywhere near them, but anyway, I am. It's going to be a close game, Bill, but I think they are going to win by, 4 points, maybe a touchdown, something like that. But they are the better team.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, that the Panthers are coming into this game playing the role that the Patriots played 2 years ago when they beat the highly favored St. Louis Rams for their first ever Super Bowl win.
Right. I mean, there are in a lot of ways mirror images from a historical standpoint, from a style standpoint. The major difference I do see, however, between what they were able to do to the Rams 2 years ago and what in Carolina's chances now, the Patriots are just a much more balanced team than the Rams were 2 years ago, without the potential flaws that the Rams had. And I think it's going to be harder for the Carolina to exploit the Patriots the way the Patriots exploited the Rams. So they're and because of that, I just don't think we're going to see history repeated here.
You know, it's interesting that you said the score would be close, because the Patriots have won most of their games this year by only a few points. I'm not sure they would know what to do if they were to jump out to a 17-0 lead in the first quarter.
That's right. This is a new trend in this league. I guess I've got to watch it. I think both teams want to play close games, and I'm not quite sure I understand. I thought the whole object of this was to win by as much as you possibly could, but John Fox of Carolina readily admits that he wants to keep games close and hopes he can win the fourth period. I mean, I guess he has a very strong stomach, Bill, but it's an unusual way of going about it. But, the Patriots don't blow people out. And I think if they did get up by a lot of points, you're right, they'd probably not know quite how to handle it and maybe not handle it that well.
Perhaps a disproportionate amount of attention has been paid over the past 2 weeks to Patriots quarterback Tom Brady and to Panthers special teams player Rod Smart, a.k.a. He Hate Me, as he used to have on the back of his jersey with the old XFL. But to which players should we be paying attention as the kickoff approaches?
Well, I mean, Brady deserves the attention. No question, he is the marquee player in a game that unfortunately does not feature a lot of marquee players, which is one reason I think it probably isn't generating the kind of excitement that maybe some other Super Bowls, recent Super Bowls, have generated. But I also think that you have to pay attention to the other quarterback, Jake Delhomme. He's the guy that the Patriots are really going to go after. They're going to make him try to beat them. And I think how Jake holds up in this game is going to, you know, determine whether the Panthers can pull an upset or not, because the Patriots feast on relatively inexperienced quarterbacks. So we'll, you know, have to see how well Jake plays.
The phrase relatively inexperienced, I think, is pertinent here because, of course, the Patriots have the experience. Many of them were there just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Is that a huge factor at this point?
You know, I think it is. I think too much is made out of experience, but I think in a Super Bowl, especially in a two-week Super Bowl where they've had a whole week to sit around and hear how good they are, hear how bad they are, have their faults examined, the weaknesses dissected, the team that's been through it, I think, can deal with it a lot better than the team that hasn't. And I think that in this case, the Patriots' experience both on the field and with the Super Bowl is going to really help them a lot in this game. I really do. And I think that Carolina has a lot to overcome because of that.
On Tuesday, the Super Bowl so-called media day, New England running back Antoine Smith was asked if he was excited to play in the Super Bowl. And one Panthers player was asked this gem of a question, Brittany or Beyonce. What are some of the doozies that you've heard while you've had your ear to the microphones?
You know, Bill, I hate to tell you this, but I've tried to tune that out. I mean, what I love, and this is the one I really love, the 2 minutes into it, you get some guy coming up and say, you know, are the distractions bothering you? You know, what do you think about media day? You know, it's like they can't wait to ask that question, even though it just started. And it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy that we want to make the players feel like, you know, media day is such a horrible thing, and it really isn't, except for that guy that was walking around this year in a Superman outfit and the cape and having the players do primeval yelling. I thought that was kind of a nice twist of the whole event.
That sounds excellent. at least as good as the guy who used to show up and say, if you were a tree, which tree would you be?
Or the Don King impersonator, yeah. It's supposed to be a serious media event. Remember that.
Paul Attner covers the National Football League for the Sporting News, and he's only a game Super Bowl Swami as well. Paul, thank you very much, and I hope you get a terrific game and then enjoy the offseason.
Bill, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Good news this week for clowns and street performers. German scientists have determined that juggling increases the size of the brain. The scientists instructed half of a group of 24 subjects to practice juggling for 3 months and found that the brains of those folks demonstrated increased gray matter on MRI scans, while the brains of those who did not learn to juggle changed not a whit. The bad news for the juggling cohort was that when they stopped practicing, they lost their newly expanded brain power. The regions of their brains which had grown shrank, which is why I'm going to keep trying to do this. Oh.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Buffalo Sabres beat the New York Rangers 3-1. The Toronto Maple Leafs topped the Atlanta Thrashers 4-1. The Dallas Stars defeated the Sharks of San Jose 3-1. The Chicago Blackhawks upended the Calgary Flames 5-3. And the Anaheim Mighty Ducks edged the Colorado Avalanche 4-3 in overtime. At the Australian Open, Justine Henin-Ardenne defeated fellow Belgian Kim Clijsters 6-3, 4-6, 6-3 for her third career Grand Slam title. Roger Federer will take on Murat Safin for the men's title tonight. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce provides a Super Bowl lock for those of our listeners who love to be entertained. But first, part of the fun of Bernice Kanner's new book entitled The Super Bowl of Advertising, How the Commercials Won the Game is the Recognition Factor. You read about and look at still photos of some of the ads that have run during the past Super Bowl broadcasts, and you find yourself saying, oh, yeah, I remember that one. But the ads that have run during this annual extravaganza of extravaganzas are not fun and games. They are extraordinarily expensive to produce and purchase, and at their best, they are little masterpieces of storytelling worth millions and millions of dollars in future business, unless they aren't. Bernice Kanner joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau to discuss the Super Bowl of advertising, how the commercials won the game. Ms. Kanner, welcome to Only a Game.
Delighted to be here.
Let's start with one of the most memorable and successful single ads ever to run during a Super Bowl, a 1984 pitch for the Macintosh computer that took advantage of the fact that it was, in fact, 1984, and featured an athletic woman running down the aisle of an auditorium and destroying the screen from which a Big Brother-type character was haranguing the masses.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Tell me about the success of that particular commercial.
Well, the voice was meant to represent IBM, and the woman was the representation of the people, power to the people, and she was smashing IBM right in the face with this very David versus Goliath kind of encounter. What was so extraordinary about this commercial is that it set the stage for the Super Bowl as a great showcase for advertising. When the game started in 1967, advertisers ran very run-of-the-mill commercials, just what you'd see every day. There were a few great moments. I mean, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing in 1972, followed by Mean Joe Green in 74, were exceptional commercials. But nothing until 1984 actually opened everyone's eyes to this as a real showcase. That commercial ran once that it was paid for, and yet it got more publicity because the news media picked it up and they played it again. So it got tremendous publicity, and it raised the bar for all advertisers after. In fact, they sold 72,000 within the first 100 hours for a commercial that never once mentioned the product or said what it was. They sold 100% more in the first 6 weeks than they had ever expected, and it was an unqualified success, despite the fact that the Apple board had great misgivings at the last minute whether they should run the commercial or not. It was so out of the ordinary as to what was being done then that it ordered the agency, Chiat Day, to get rid of the 2 minutes that it had reserved. The agency sold one back to the station, and then pretended it couldn't get rid of the other. And that's how we got this moment in advertising history.
Terrific. Now, I want to jump forward 15 years to a commercial that's not nearly as ominous as the 1984 commercial. This one was for beer.
Green Buddies, I got some bad news. We got canned.
What did you just say?
Canned? Who got canned?
Okay, freeze the swamp. You guys can talk.
Of course we can talk, you bonehead.
What does canned mean?
Well, all you said was button.
We were reading from the script. You should try it sometime.
What does canned mean?
Don't be fired.
Canned means fired? I can't breathe. Gonna get sick?
Wait, no, don't get sick.
Getting sick?
Put your head between your legs.
Someone get him a bucket.
Now, how is that supposed to sell beer?
That was, of course, part of a series of ads featuring the beer-selling Budweiser frogs. I wonder why they did get canned.
Well, the answer of how is that supposed to sell beer is brilliantly. They got canned because, for my money, you could still keep running the frogs. I find them absolutely endearing. But I think that there is a set limit, a wear-out factor, and that the frogs were just beginning to do that wear-out slide. Anheuser-Busch is a very astute advertiser. It sees when things are just beginning to crest and pulls it before things really wear out.
Is it always the agency that decides when the wear-out factor is coming into effect, or don't they sometimes try these ads out on focus groups first and maybe they're making the decision?
In Budweiser, it's actually the corporation that's calling the shots. In some less informed clients, it's the agencies calling the shot. And I'm thinking of a classic example of the Just for Feet commercial that ran a few years ago, in which the agency and the retailer got into a dreadful court suit afterward. Do you remember the commercial? Four white guys in a Humvee track a black barefoot Kenyan runner and force shoes onto his feet as he protests?
Happily, that one I wasn't watching. I guess I got up to get a soft drink or something at that point.
Well, that's rare because more people stay tuned to watch the commercials and get up and go to the bathroom or to the fridge when the action is on. Even if the game is a blowout, you can expect people will stay tuned to see what's happening. And this is very unusual because every day advertising is the enemy. It's what you want to eliminate. This is the one day of the year when people stay tuned to watch the commercials.
You quote the man that you describe in your book as an ad legend, Jerry Delafemina, as saying, quote, "The end of the dot-com economy came not when NASDAQ nosedived in March, but at the 2000 Super Bowl." What exactly did he mean by that, and was he right?
The 2000 Super Bowl really captured the zeitgeist of its time, an era of high-flying arrogance. And in that 2000 game, you had 17 advertisers that were dot-com something or others. By the end of the year, seven of them were completely out of business and two more teetering. So you see people who were harvesting all of their seed money, plopping it into a one-minute or 30-second ad and thinking that that was going to carry them to a successful IPO. It was tremendously arrogant hubris. It was capturing what the moment of time was, as Jerry Delafemina says, in a way that is most visible.
There's real pressure on the ad agencies to come up with the best commercial they've ever produced for the Super Bowl. Is that why so many of the ads have featured famous models or pop stars with whom we're already very familiar?
Pop stars and celebrities give you borrowed interest. You're interested in Madonna, so you watch the commercial. You're interested in Michael Jordan, so you watch him and Larry Bird do something extraordinary, bouncing a basketball across a river through a hoop in a nothing but net commercial. Or Cindy Crawford go into a Pepsi deprivation chamber. Those work, but those are not the only things that work. You could have special effects. Remember the Michael Jordan Hair Jordan commercial where Jordan plays with the Looney Tunes character?
Mm-hmm.
That was a special effect. But I think that you could also have minimal effects and just a great idea. I'm thinking of a commercial that Federal Express ran a few years ago called Apology, in which you just saw color bars. As a narrator said, we had something spectacular planned, dancing elephants, singing giraffes, whatever. But some boob at our agency, or shall I say ex-ad agency, used the wrong carrier. I think that
I wish I'd seen that one. It's another one I missed.
It so brilliantly demonstrates the idea that it absolutely, positively has to get there.
Now, remembering a lot of the ads which you've collected in your book is enjoyable enough, but somewhere around the middle of the book, I found myself thinking, all this is really about fooling people. They're being tricked into buying something not because they need it or because it's good or better than its competitor, but because somebody's written a very funny ad for it. Did you ever find yourself thinking that way while collecting the ads?
Everything in life is advertising or sales. Politics certainly is. You try to put the best light on something. They also say that great advertising kills a product faster than bad advertising. Certainly with Bert and Harry Peels in New York many, many, many years ago, they were these delightful characters. Everybody loved the commercials and bought the beer. They tasted the beer, hated the beer, and never bought it again. So great advertising can definitely accelerate the decline of a product. There's a little bit of Machiavellian principle in advertising, but it's whether you see that as demonic or not. I certainly see it as strategic.
Do you have any clear sense of a formula, perhaps, to explain why some extremely expensive Super Bowl ads succeed magnificently and others fail utterly?
I don't think there's any one formula because, as I said, there's lots of approaches that you can use. The one thing you cannot do is bore your audience. You bore your audience, you make them dislike you.
Hmm.
I'm afraid that we may be having some of that tomorrow.
Now, why is that? What leads you to anticipate? I mean, that's like saying my favorite team may not show up tomorrow. Why would you anticipate that?
Because we have three erectile dysfunction ads in, and they're all talking about rational benefits. And that scares me a little bit. Anytime you have a drug company advertise, there's an expression that they say when it comes to money, it's not funny. And yet brokers and other financial services companies have shown that it can be funny. I don't think drug companies have ever shown that it can be funny. So I think we're in for some very sober, factual commercials.
Is there any particular ad or maybe more than one that you're really looking forward to seeing this time around?
Well, Anheuser-Busch just finished their commercials. They do it up to the minute on the end, and I'm always eager to see what they come up with. Pepsi, I know, will have another brilliant commercial. I'm very interested to see what America Online does with the Toodles. I'd like to see if the erectile dysfunction products stand up against each other, if you will.
Shame on you.
I'm shamed.
In the Super Bowl of Advertising, How Commercials Won the Game, published by Bloomberg Press, Bernice Kanner has written about many of the ads that have run during the Super Bowl over the years. Ms. Kanner, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Playing in the Super Bowl used to be the ultimate dream for NFL players, but now there's a bowl that rivals it. Jack Williams of member station KUHF in Houston recently attended the cornerstone event for a burgeoning multi-billion dollar industry, and he has this report.
Welcome to the 10th annual EA Sports Madden Bowl Challenge.
On a rainy Thursday night at a club about 10 miles from Reliance Stadium, there's a palpable game day buzz. But the spectators, the camera crews, and the NFL players aren't here to obsess about Super Bowl 38. In fact, the athletes present have joysticks in their hands, not footballs. It's Madden Bowl 2004 here in Houston as players like Baltimore's Terrell Suggs vie for the title of best Madden NFL football player in the league.
We love Madden. I mean, that's all we do every day. You know, I mean, when you play professional football, you know, you work all day, and then you go home and play Madden. You know, especially for us young guys who don't have a wife and kids and everything. We have a lot of time for Madden.
As huge video screens display the action, the players use body English to control their video counterparts. They seem to take this as seriously as any real football game they've ever played in. Jacksonville's Byron Leftwich says it's the next best thing to playing on Sunday.
It's as real as it can get for a game. You know, it ain't like the real thing because when you get hit on this game, it don't hurt. But it's great, man. It's, you know, it's as real as you can get in the game. You know, it has everything in the game that happens in real life football.
When Madden NFL football started 14 years ago, it was just another video game produced by the California-based company Electronic Arts. Since then, the Madden game has sold 30 million copies and is the most popular sports video game on the market. Jordan Edelstein is senior product manager for Madden NFL Football. He says the game has become part of the NFL landscape.
All the NFL players are heavy users of Madden NFL Football. When we take the game around to players, the first thing they do is they go and check their ratings. And invariably, someone's complaining about speed. Someone's not strong enough. Oh, I was faster last year. What are you doing? In fact, John Madden tells a story. The only player who's ever complained that his ratings were too high was Emmitt Smith in one of the versions from the 90s. He said, John, you made me too fast. I'm not that fast.
Edelstein says 295 employees, including graphic designers, programmers, and artists at an EA office in Orlando, spend most of the year working on the latest version of the Madden game. including innovative new angles that have influenced how football is televised.
What's fun about Madden is you can look at a play from any angle and defy all the laws of physics and gravity, etc., and the TV broadcasters are starting to do that as well with the camera that swings over the tops of the fields, miking up players so you can hear what they're saying during the game. Those are all things that you can do in Madden and have been able to do, and the TV companies, the broadcasters are starting to mimic that.
The video game industry is a $10 billion a year business, with EA Sports capturing about one-fifth of that. ESPN Sports business reporter Darren Rovell says the fight for market share is getting even more intense.
To be at a point where these video game companies feel that they need to go and scout out every stadium for every little detail is unbelievable, but that's what they're doing. Madden has to compete with all the other guys, and that's how it works, that they have to get an edge up, and the edge up is making the next year's games more detailed than the year before.
For most NFL athletes, being on the cover of Madden NFL Football has become a quest. Michael Vick was on last year's cover and called it an honor to be picked so early in his career. Rovell says video game covers are now as important as any endorsement.
In terms of endorsement deals, these video game companies have gotten away with a lot because the video game is now the Wheaties box of this generation. And so Wheaties didn't pay a lot of money. And now if you're having 5 to 10 football players calling up saying, I want to be on your box, obviously the market value is going to decline. And this is just one of those things, just for their buddies. It's the prestige endorsement.
Back at the Madden Bowl, Byron Leftwich says it's somewhat surreal, controlling himself on a video screen. But it's something he's getting used to.
It's something as a kid, you know, you always envision yourself playing on a football game, you know, because you played so many games growing up. And now we're those people in the game, so it's a lot of fun to go out there and have an opportunity to play with yourself.
Work on Madden NFL 2005 has already started. EA Sports expects to sell 4 million copies of Madden NFL 2004 this year. 22-0. For Only a Game, I'm Jack Williams in Houston.
22-0. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Settle down, take me back to TEXAS. Take me back to Texas, TEXAS.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Wayland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, rally,
the Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Goal! The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports and maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines.
In yesterday's NBA action, Philadelphia foiled New Orleans 85-82. Detroit edged Toronto 92-89 in overtime. Miami beat the Clippers of L.A. by a score of 97-88. Milwaukee dispatched Cleveland 101-95. Golden State stifled Chicago 101-81. And Washington withstood Phoenix 105-100. Elsewhere, the New York Knicks nixed Boston 92-74. Utah downed Memphis 85-79. And Minnesota manhandled the Los Angeles Lakers 97-84. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the poetic side of the Super Bowl rendered once more in haiku. But first, direct from Houston, where the football fans are outnumbered only by the media, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins us from the studios of member station KUHF. Hello, Charlie.
I'm wearing my Super Bowl credential right now.
Well, I think we have to start with your standard proclamation regarding the Super Bowl.
Well, even more vivid in my mind this year, because I'm actually in the belly of the beast down here and can conclude. Stop giggling. This is important. The Super Bowl is good.
Thank you very much. Now we can move on. Last week, you said that your goal would be to capture one declarative sentence that escaped the notice of all the other media folks in Houston this week. Did you have any luck?
Absolutely not. No, it was not possible. Unless, of course, it was the guy out in front of my hotel who said, "Would you like a cab, sir?"
Ah, well, make sure that makes it into the story.
But as far as the athletes, no.
Okay. I understand that you talked to He Hate Me, a.k.a. Rod Smart, and I'm wondering if he managed to make his subjects and verbs agree when you spoke with him.
Well, they do agree. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, in his argot, in his parlance, they do agree. He's actually quite an entertaining and very well-spoken and reasonably intelligent guy who's milking this for all it's worth.
What a surprise.
But, you know, if you look at the Carolina Panthers, they really are the Gypsy Caravan. Their quarterback is out of the World League in Europe. Of course, He Hate Me is one of the stars of their special teams from the XFL. So, I mean, they really are. The story of the Carolina Panthers, especially opposed to the New England Patriots, who are put together with computerized and mathematical precision by Scott Paoli and Bill Belichick, is an interesting contrast.
Has being at the site of the game made you privy to any other particular wisdom that you care to impart at this point? I mean, it's not every day I get to talk to somebody who's there.
Well, Bill, everyone misses you. First of all,
the world of football is incomplete.
A Super Bowl without Bill Littlefield. I mean, people are wondering when you're going to finally show up for one. They keep holding a room for you. Holding a credential for Paul Tagliabue himself is very upset
that
he's never seen you in a Super Bowl.
I'm really touched. One of the many Super Bowl-related stories out of this week indicates that it is four times more dangerous to drive on Super Bowl Sunday than it is to drive on New Year's Eve. Do you suppose that will have more folks staying home for the game, or do they just stay later at the parties they're attending?
What you can conclude, if we are all paying attention to the news as we should this week, is that everybody should just bring sleeping bags to their Super Bowl parties, and if you happen to be hosting one, you'll have 19 people in your den the next morning.
In a story that combines football and politics, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, a guest of President Bush at last week's State of the Union address, turns out to be registered to vote in at least two states. No wonder Bush wants Brady on the Republican side, eh?
Well, two things. Number one of the states is not Massachusetts.
No.
However, he certainly does have the Bay State attitude towards elections. And I don't think there's any question that he's a perfect person for the Bush campaign, because Lord knows they're going to find a way for him to vote in both states.
The Los Angeles Dodgers are now the property of Boston developer Frank McCourt, which I think is exciting because I think we can support a National League team here in Boston. What do you think?
No, the Dodgers are staying where they are. The question, of course, what this does make interesting from a purely baseball standpoint is whether or not this revives the Nomar Garciaparra story, because Frank McCourt has already expressed his desire to have Nomar play for him. This may revive those talks again.
Aaron Boone, who plays third base for the New York Yankees, either didn't read his contract or didn't care what it said. He wasn't supposed to play basketball this winter, and now he's torn up his knee doing just that. Am I right in thinking this may cost Mr. Boone almost $6 million?
Look, the guy hits one home run. He beats the Red Sox. He gets a buck and a half in the postseason. And then he goes out and squanders a $6 million contract that he didn't deserve in the first place. I have no sympathy here.
Byron Scott lost his job with the Nets on Monday. I'm sure he was not the first NBA head coach to be fired while he had a team in first place. Actually, I'm not sure. Was he?
I don't know, but I'll tell you for a fact, there's never been a team, it's never been the case in any sport where the top two teams in the division both lost their coaches within 2 days of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because 2 days after Byron Scott was fired, Jim O'Brien quit as the coach of the Boston Celtics because he couldn't get along with Danny Ainge, who's running things into the ground there right now. This is further proof that the NBA is a one-conference league right now. The longest tenured coach in the Eastern Conference is Terry Stotts in Atlanta, whose team is not even within an area code of 500, whom I wouldn't know if he came in here right now and sat in my lap.
Lydon Murtha, the University of Minnesota's most celebrated football recruit this year, backed out of his commitment to the school because during a recruiting visit there last month, he was taken with some other recruits to a strip club. So the morally strong Murtha, who said, "I'm not into that sort of thing," decided instead to attend Nebraska.
Well, Mr. Murtha clearly still wants to play big-time football because it's not like he carried himself off to Azusa Christian or Liberty University or something. I mean, he did go to the University of Nebraska, which, whatever their ecclesiastical predilections are, they still play pretty good football.
Moving on to hockey, Eric Lindros, now of the New York Rangers, suffered his eighth concussion in a game on Wednesday night. Remarkably, Rangers coach Glenn Sather said later, quote, "The doctors don't think it's that severe." Can an eighth concussion be not that severe?
No, and Sather's neurological credentials are roughly the same as those of a guy who fixes my car. This should be the end of his career, as much as I don't like to say that because I really do like him. I've written about him several times. Just the way he plays with the size and the recklessness with which he plays, he's never going to get any better at this, and he is now entering Troy Aikman, Merrill Hodge, Art Monk territory.
Mm.
And, yes, I do believe that this ought to be enough.
Charlie, you and I have both heard lots of stories about moms throwing out their children's baseball card collections. But this week, a mom figured—
In my case, it was comic books,
yeah, there was,
way,
and I have an even sadder tale this week. Lee Walker, the goalkeeper on an undistinguished soccer team, Scarborough, had gotten the players on the much better Chelsea team to sign his shirt after he had held Chelsea to just one goal. And shortly thereafter, Mr. Walker's mom washed the shirt.
No!
Said Walker, "I'm gutted."
He didn't use a waterproof marker? I mean, there are 9-year-olds waiting around hotel lobbies in America who could teach him a lesson in how to get autographs.
Not surprisingly, the setting of world records goes on, even in the shadow of the Super Bowl. This week, Serge England Arbona ran 152.27 miles on a treadmill in 24 hours, thereby apparently breaking at least 4 world records. You want to take a run at this one?
And now, you know what? And 8 million hamsters yawn in boredom. Big deal.
Finally, Charlie, 4 top Swiss snowboarders are threatening to become citizens of the United Arab Emirates if the Swiss government doesn't, quote, support them. You think the Swiss will cave?
Whoa, dude, we're in the Emirates now. There's lots of sand. Whoa. That's a cool hat. Whoa. Never mind.
Charlie Pierce is our man at the Super Bowl. He also writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Can I tell him that you won't be using your room?
As my conversation with Charlie Pierce indicated, the power and the glory of the Super Bowl notwithstanding, football is not the only game in town, yours or mine, even on Super Bowl weekend. Today, for example, such track and field worthies as runners Haile Gebrselassie and Duratu Tulu, as well as Olympic champion pole vaulter Stacey Dragila, will be competing in the Boston Indoor Games. On the morning of the Super Bowl itself, assuming you've already done your shopping for chips, dips, and things of that nature, you can watch either Marat Safin or Roger Federer win the Australian Open. Tomorrow afternoon, on the sacred day itself, number 7 Texas Tech and number 4 Texas will square off in what promises to be a dandy example of women's basketball at its best. And it's a fair bet that at least some of the Texans in attendance won't get home in time for the kickoff. South Africa is hosting the West Indies in a critical cricket match on the very day of football's famous fest, and, unlikely as it seems, at 7 Eastern time, mere minutes after the game of games has begun, the Hoopsters of Robert Morris and Long Island University of Brooklyn will battle each other in Brooklyn. Boy, I wonder how the athletic directors and conference secretary responsible for scheduling that one are feeling, and whether, as the cliche has it, both teams will come to play, or whether players on both sides will be trying to sneak into the locker room to watch Pat's Panthers every time the whistle blows, and whether the refs who drew the short straws and have to work that game will be wearing those little wristwatch TVs. For some, it's the weekend of the year's most important football game. For us here at Only a Game, it's that and more. It's the day for the return of one of our favorite traditions, Super Bowl Haiku. To mark the 10th occasion upon which Only a Game has celebrated the Super Bowl with a series of 17-syllable verses, of a sort, we are retiring the most durable of our efforts, a little number made famous by veteran Super Bowl Haiku player George Carter. More on that soon. Also to mark 10 years in the Super Bowl Haiku Dodge, we have another first, a player, a real football player who'll be involved in the Super Bowl tomorrow. Patriots long snapper Brian Kinchin now reads a haiku regarding tomorrow's game.
Same plays, uniform, same music, same everything. No super deal. Right.
Thank you, Brian. You're a good sport as well as a fine long snapper. And now, Super Bowl Haiku X.
Pats and Panthers pace. Scowl at tickets to Texas? Why no New Orleans?
Clutching game ticket, he says.
I don't know.
She smiles, says.
I'll tape the ads. XFL's Rod Smart laughs into his panther paw. Super, he hate me.
In both locker rooms, they moan.
We get no respect.
Yeah, and they're both right.
Locker room hush breaks.
Football!
Coach screams.
Is desire!
Players think.
No. Pain. Super Sunday sells suds, services, slick sedans, sweet, sure,
sudden sex!
Showdown in Houston with Southern style tailgating. Yeehaw! Cowboy up.
From far away, games sound. Not like battle, but like cheering for battle.
One, two, three, four, five. Our players don't take no jive. My shirt's too tight.
Yay!
Behind the grunting, play finds out its swirling shape. Blind linemen grunt on.
It's so exciting.
What? The game? The halftime show?
Mrs. Tom Brady.
Halftime. Players rest while P. Diddy performs. His 15 minutes, done.
It makes me tremble.
The Patriots corner blitz?
Mr. Beyonce.
Panthers roar.
Then punt.
Patriots stand tall.
Then punt.
On couch, drunk fan snores.
What the Panthers need is more play action, you see?
You're smart.
Gah.
Ready, Go, fight, win! Sack that quarterback! Again!
Careful! He's dreamy.
I just can't stand it.
What, the anticipation?
Mr. Tom Brady.
The Super Bowl. America. Flags flying. I hate when it ends.
Astride the known world, the Super Bowl, game of games, dwarfs the other sports.
Are you crazy? In Greece we have your Super Bowl. It's 3,000 years old.
Silly coach.
No, George, look up. We've raised that one to the rafters here in the studio.
Oh, yeah, you told me. It's been retired. Guys hitting guys who hit them back while we all watch. No namby-pambies.
And now there's nothing left but the playing of Super Bowl 38. Let us all hope the actual football won't be anticlimactic. Go Panthers, go Pats.
Gone so long, I can't wait to get back home. Home to the Lone Star State another day. I just can't wait. Look out, boy, I'm headed your way. I got a mind that wanders in a 57 Chevrolet. Hold on tight, I got a license to fly. With the pedal to the metal, watch me roll on by while I'm boogie back to Texas.
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 We're gonna boogie back to Texas. Hey, Jason, come in here now.
Rolling out of New York, Philadelphia, PA, Pittsburgh, Wheeling, West Virginia on the way. Rolling through Ohio, gonna make it through Kentucky. Gonna make it by the morning if I'm fast and lucky.
Hold on, boys, I'm headed your way. I'm gonna boogie back to Texas for the U.S. of A.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Scott Jagow at WFAE in Charlotte, from Paul Franklin at KUHF in Houston, and, of course, from Only a Game's Hut Hut Haiku players, Walter Dixon, Christine Fischera, George Carter, John Marston, Sean Cole, Steph Kotsonis, George Hicks, Keith Shields, Ted O'Brien, Anna Benstead, James Isaacs, Kelvin Brooks, and New England Patriots long snapper Brian Kinchin. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or perhaps share your poems with other listeners in our haiku forum, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from our Haiku Rookie of the Year, Matt Odette.
We're kicking it Only a Game. I'm quite insane. You know it's going right to the brain. Bill Littlefield kicking the commentaries.
That sure is some fly rhyming, Matt. Shout out to the homies in Yokohama. What did I say? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Boogie back to Texas.
Boogie back to Texas.
Boogie back to Texas.
Boogie, boogie.
Boogie back to Texas.
We're gonna boogie back to Texas. Do it 8 beats to the mile. Yeah, all right. New York, Dallas, to Austin. Yeah. We're gonna boogie back to Texas. Do it 8 beats.
See, I'm on my way. Boogie!
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.